Hello, my name's Mike Talty. I work for Microsoft in the UK. And this is one of a number of short videos around a new framework that's coming as part of Silverlight 4 and also as part of .NET 4, the full .NET framework, that's called the Managed Extensibility Framework, or MEF for short. So it's coming in both Silverlight and .NET 4. I'm going to look at it here in the realms of Silverlight applications. And in a nutshell, what this framework is about is enabling you to sort of compose a Silverlight application out of a number of very loosely coupled pieces that can use different mechanisms for discovering each other at runtime in order to come together and form an application. If that sounds a little bit abstract, then perhaps to make it more concrete, think of plug-in architectures. Think of something like Visual Studio, which has the capability to plug in lots of different designers and build engines and those kinds of things. Or think of something like Outlook, where you can write add-ins yourself using .NET for Outlook and plug them into the core application. And MEF enables those kinds of scenarios if you want to think of it in a more concrete way. Now, just to provide a few pointers before we get started, if you want to follow along and you want to know how to get started with Silverlight 4 and MEF, then the first thing you need to do is download Visual Studio 2010. The Beta 2 is the build I'm using here. You can get that from msdnmicrosoft.com/vstudio. That's all you need. You don't need the other bits in order to find the download for Beta 2. That will get you Visual Studio 2010. You would then also want the pieces for Silverlight 4 development in Visual Studio 2010 Beta 2. Best place to go to get those is to pop over to silverlight.net, pop over to Get Started over here, and then down on the right-hand side, you will find a link to go and get everything for the Silverlight 4 Beta. And MEF is part of that Silverlight 4 Beta. So follow the instructions there. You'll get the tools in the SDK in order to install the Silverlight 4 development environment bits into Visual Studio 2010 Beta 2. It's worth saying as well that MEF, there's also a version of it on CodePlex for .NET 3.5 and Silverlight 3. So if you pop over to mef.codeplex.com, you can find the previews of MEF on there to play with against .NET 3.5. That's the existing .NET framework, and Silverlight 3, that's the existing released version of Silverlight. Finally, if you're trying to find more of these videos, if you pop over to Channel 9, this is where I'll put the videos. If you go to channel9.msdn.com/niners/mtalty, that's me, and you'll find these videos here as and when they're published. And if you're trying to find me in any way, you can pop over to my website, which is just at mtalty.com, and then you'll find my blog. And finally, if you want to get hold of me via email, you can just mail me at mike.talty@microsoft.com. Okay, so with all that introductory stuff said, let's get started and take a bit of a look at Managed Extensibility Framework. Welcome to video number 3. I'd recommend watching video 2 before this, so don't just jump into this one on its own if you've not seen the other two that came before it, because we're pretty much going to take the same code that we had at the end of video 2 and continue it here in video 3, so it's worth watching that first. In video 2 we talked a lot about import and export, and we looked at a lot of flexibility around how we can import things like fields, properties, methods, types, by interface. We can import lists of things, enumerables of things, and so on. We did a lot of different things around that. What we didn't talk about was how is MEF finding, locating, resolving the types that are in play. So we just magically seem to have these types, and MEF just seems to magically discover them. So what I want to do here is start to talk about how MEF is finding these things and how we can take a bit more control of that if we need to. I mean, it's been doing a pretty decent job so far, but we'll try and open the lid a little bit on that and talk around things like catalogs. So we'll do a little bit of that here. I expect that we'll probably wander off into other videos to finish that off, but we'll at least make the start here about talking about catalogs and how MEF is starting to find these things that it's dealing with. So let's close down Notepad and let's drop over into Visual Studio. Okay, let's just take a tour around the project, because I've changed it slightly, just slightly, since the previous video. What we've got is our main project here, main Silverlight application. So that's building a ZAP for us. And it's got this little XAML page which just defines a button. So we have this button here. And the button has a click handler on it. And that's implemented straight in the code behind, which lives here. And the code behind says that this class imports a word processor. I've changed it slightly to import that using this interface, iWordProcessor, which is very simple and we'll see it in a second. We allow for defaults, so if Meth cannot find, cannot compose for us a word processor, we don't mind and we'll accept a null value, that's fine. And in our constructor down here, we do our one and only explicit call to Meth from the application here, where we say part initializer satisfy imports on this instance, which causes Meth to go off and try and compose this word processor for us. I've moved interfaces like iWordProcessor into this interfaces library. And so, of course, our main app has to reference that interfaces library. If we take a look at the interfaces library, we have iWordProcessor, which simply says a word processor has a text engine, and at the moment you can get and set it. And if you look at iTextEngine, which I've also moved into this library, you can see that an iTextEngine just says a text engine has a name and can process a bunch of text. There are no references to any concrete implementations of this, either here or here. The concrete implementations are in these two library projects down here, TextEngine library, so of course that has to reference the interfaces library, and it implements iTextEngine, and it does that on this class here called TextEngine, and exports it to Meth using type of iTextEngine. So we're importing and exporting by interface there. And if we go to the other library, Word Processor library, it also references the interfaces library, and it says a word processor is an implementation of iWordProcessor, and it exports that as an iWordProcessor whilst importing iTextEngine. So you kind of get the idea as how all those pieces are coming together. Now, if we go back to our main code behind, let's just go and do that here. What's interesting at the moment is that our main application does not reference the two concrete implementation assemblies, the two libraries down here. And so consequently, those two things are not in our ZAP. And so consequently, there's no way on earth really that Meth could ever find the actual text engine, this guy here, if we can just open that up, and the actual word processor, if we go down and talk about this guy here. There's no way that Meth is going to be able to make those things magically appear, because those two types of assemblies that aren't even part of our build package, they're not even in our ZAP. And so at the moment, if we go and run this code, let's just press F5, and then we'll get the UI on the screen and click our button again. There's our button coming up. Click that. What we should see is that we don't have a word processor. Meth will not be able to do that composing for us, and if we can just hover here, I don't know if we can, there we go. So the word processor is null. That's because we allowed defaults, and Meth could not find an exported word processor to plug in there, because it just isn't there. But one of the interesting things about this is that our current code is fine. It doesn't have a static dependency on the actual text engine or the actual word processor, but it does kind of have a runtime dependency on someone providing some kind of word processor and some kind of text engine. So one way we could get those things provided is by going out and making sure that those particular assemblies were part of our ZAP. So we can make that happen in a simple way by just adding references to them. Even though we don't really need them at compile time, we're adding references to them to get them into the ZAP at runtime. So let's add a reference, and we'll go to the text engine and the word processor library and add references to those. So those will now be built into our ZAP. Let's press F5 again. Click the button. And if we take a look at our word processor, you can see we have a word processor plugged in, and we have a text engine plugged into that word processor. So clearly, part initializer.satisfy imports in this vanilla sort of way that we're using it here is prepared to go and find types that it can locate within the assemblies that are located in our ZAP. So that's pretty powerful in itself. We didn't have to do a thing. As long as the types are around in our ZAP and are exported correctly, part initializer satisfy imports will find those things. It will just go and find them from the ZAP. So we get that for free and we don't have to do anything about it. Now, what is it that part initialize or satisfy imports is actually doing for us? Well, it's making use of a type we haven't seen yet, which is called the composition container. As the name suggests, that's a place in MEF where a lot of the work is done. Essentially, the types that need to be composed are composed by that container. And part initialize or satisfy imports uses a default or an implicit container. And it also is prepared to cause the creation of that container if you haven't already created it and set it yourself. So let's look at how we can take a bit more control around that. Let's put some code into our main page class here. Now, arguably, this code should perhaps be more at the application level, so it should probably be more in code that lives in the app class. But I'm going to keep it here because it lets me keep it on the screen all in one page of code as opposed to switching between the two files. But bear in mind that what we're doing here is really application level stuff, I guess. But what we'll do is we'll just put a call onto this main page here after initialize component. Let's go for initialize, I'll keep the US spelling, let's say initialize container. So we'll just write that call down here, write a function. And there's our function with that in there. And let's go ahead and create ourselves a composition container. We'll call it container. We'll create one of those. Now, that's just creating an instance, but we could go and program against that one explicitly and do explicit work with it. But if we want to make it the default container, then what we need to do is call composition host dot initialize container with this container. And it's important to realize that we need to do this before we get to anybody calling one of these. Because if somebody calls one of these, the default container will be created and populated, and by the time we get here, it's kind of too late. So we need to call this first and set up that default container. And with the default container in place, this kind of code will start to use that default container. And we can see that straight away because even though we currently have all our types packaged into our ZAP and our code was working just a second ago, our code will no longer be working because what we're now doing is creating an empty container and causing part initialize or satisfy imports to use it. And it won't find any types in there. So if we press F5, what we should find is that we're back to a situation, let's just get our breakpoint, where we no longer have a word processor in play. If we can find it, you can see it's gone back to null. So simply by switching this one call here, you know, if I comment that out, then our types will be resolved because we're using a container that's created for us by some other code. So you can see now we have a word processor. And if I comment that back in, changing that default container to be an empty one, excuse me, then we won't get a word processor because we've replaced the container that's being used by default with an empty container. I hope that kind of makes sense. So how do we go about actually populating this container? Well, it turns out there's lots of different ways we can do it. The way we'll look at here is by using a thing called a catalog. And what we'll do, if we take a look at the constructor for this thing, we can pass it nothing, which is what we're already doing. We can pass it a bunch of things called export providers, which we'll talk about in subsequent videos perhaps. But here we've got a third constructor which takes a thing called a composable part catalog. That's an abstract base class. It also takes again a bunch of things called export providers, which we'll not pass to it right now. So what we can do is pass this thing a catalog. So let's say we'll have a catalog and we'll go and define one of those things. Now one of the catalogs that you can use is a thing called a type catalog. And as the name suggests, this is a catalog of a bunch of types. So we could make one of these. And into that, we could go and add, one way or another, a list of types that form part of the catalog. So in our case, this is going to be our type of word processor and type of text engine. So we're really just explicitly listing those types that need to be brought into play in order to satisfy the imports on our actual class that we're playing with here. And so with that in play, we're now feeding the catalog into the container. The container is being set as the default. So this is being set as the default, which this thing up here will then pick up. So if we go back and press F5 again, we should find that we're back to a working implementation of a word processor being plugged in and composed for us by MEF. So if we hover over this in the debugger, you can see we have a word processor. Can't quite get to that. And the word processor has a text engine once again. So we explicitly plugged in our own type catalog as opposed to relying on the default behavior that this causes to happen if you haven't already done this kind of work here. Now, notice that we've kind of done a strange thing here, really. If we are building an application that imports a bunch of types, and the application should really only know about the interfaces, it shouldn't know about the concrete types, otherwise why is it really importing these things? What we've done is we've actually referenced the two assemblies that contain the concrete types, and we've used those types here. So we've really kind of tightly linked ourselves to those two particular concrete types. Now, I'm only really doing that to demonstrate the type catalog. You could use the type catalog without adding these two references here and use some other mechanism like a configuration file for figuring out what the actual types are that you need to add to the type catalog. So don't take away the idea that if you use the type catalog you have to have references like this and tightly sort of link yourself to the assemblies and the types that actually make up the plugins. You don't. You could do this dynamically through configuration, but I hope you appreciate it's much easier for just demonstration purposes just to use type of like this here, but I just want to make that point. If we just explore this type catalog thing a little bit, let's jump to the definition of it in the framework. A type catalog is something you can construct with a bunch of types one way or another, and then it exposes a queryable property called parts. It also exposes another method called getExports, given some definition of an import. So basically what we've got here is the notion that you can give this thing an import and ask which exports match that import. And you can also walk up to this collection, if you like, of parts and query it and ask for some kind of query against it. If we look at a composable part definition for a moment, let's just go and take a look at that. Basically, a composable part definition is something that has a bunch of exports, a bunch of imports, and a bunch of metadata. And we'll kind of just say that about it. So that idea that we started with right at the heart of video one, the idea that a component is some sort of list of imports and some sort of list of exports, is really right here in this type that we're looking at on the screen. Let me close that file down. And back to that type catalog. So what we've got here is something that can take a bunch of types and expose them back to somebody as something that's queryable and can answer the question, give me the exports that match this import. And obviously the container is going to use this catalog in order to do that kind of work on its behalf. Notice that you can't change the types in the catalog. Once you've constructed it, that's it. There's no notion here of adding anything to the catalog as we go along, which is kind of an interesting thing. Let's close that back down and go back to our main code. So type catalog is the first catalog that we've looked at here. So another kind of catalog that exists in the framework is a thing called an assembly catalog. And you can probably guess what that does. It goes and uses the types that are exported from that particular assembly. So instead of listing types like this explicitly, we could go and list assemblies. So let's say assembly catalog. And I'm going to call this catalog 1, let's say. And we'll create a new one. And it wants an assembly. So one way in which we could give it an assembly, and bear in mind the comments I said earlier on about explicitly referencing things, we have more than one way of loading up an assembly, as we'll see in a second. But one way in which we could get an assembly is by saying something like type of wordprocessor.assembly. That's one way we can get to that assembly. And that really works only because we've got an explicit reference to that particular assembly. But notice that an assembly catalog is surfacing the types from an assembly, but not multiple assemblies. So if we wanted to get our other type into there, we'd have to say assembly catalog catalog 2 equals new assembly catalog type of text engine dot assembly, because that's actually in a different assembly. And now what we've got is two catalogs in play. And if we just go and take a look at the definition of assembly catalog again, let's just go to the definition. Once again, it is a catalog, which kind of means it derives from this type here. And you construct it up with an assembly. You can get that assembly back later on if you need to get it back. And again, it has a queryable property called parts, and it can answer this question, given an import, get me some exports. So let's close that back down. Again, there's no way to add other assemblies to this after you've sort of constructed it. So with this in place, it's very difficult to see how we can feed both of these catalogs into our container here. Now, it is actually possible, but the simplest way of doing it is using a thing called an aggregate catalog. So what we can do is create an aggregate catalog, we'll call it catalog, create a new one of those. And you can see that it takes, or one of the things it can do is take any number of composable part catalogs. So we can feed this catalog 1 and catalog 2. So now we've created that aggregate catalog. And with that lined up the way it is right now, we should be able to rebuild. And we are providing our default container, which has this aggregate catalog, which contains catalog for one assembly and a catalog for my other assembly, which means ultimately that when we put our UI back on the screen and click our button, that we should get a fully composed word processor. So if we go and take a look at our word processor property, there it is composed, and there is its text engine composed again. So once again, we're just being explicit here and creating an assembly catalog and another one for the other assembly, and then an aggregate catalog, passing it into this container and making that the default container. Now, if we just go back and take a look at that aggregate catalog, let's look at the definition of that in the framework. It's a little bit more meaty than the other catalogs we looked at. So you can see you can construct it with a bunch of other catalogs. That's something you can do. But then you can also get back to the catalogs as an iCollection. So what that means is, if we go back to our code, just see that, we could walk up to this catalog and say catalog.catalogs.add or remove. So there's the idea that we can alter this catalog after we've constructed it, and indeed after we've gone round and given it to the container and so on. So there's an idea of dynamism here that we haven't seen before. We can actually change things with this catalog. Let's look at it a bit more. We've got the thing that we've seen, you know, just part of what it means to be a catalog. You can query the parts. And down here somewhere, you can get the exports that match an import. But then to support this notion of being able to change the catalogs, there's a changing event and a changed event and virtual methods to fire those things. So really, an aggregate catalog is a collection of other catalogs that can then be added to and subtracted from after it's been built. And this opens up a whole idea that having composed something, there is the possibility that the container can be altered after you've done some composition. And Meph is really smart in that if a container is altered after the composition's gone on, it opens up a whole process called recomposition, where you might take another look at how things were composed. We'll talk about that in a follow-on video. We won't talk about that here, where we're trying to really focus on catalogs. Now, you can probably see a way in which we could refer to less types explicitly here by making use of the sort of deployment packaging stuff that lives in Silverlight. So instead of working this way and referencing these explicit types, what I could do is get rid of that, create a blank catalog up front, and then reach into our deployment. So we could say for each, let's say assembly part in deployment.current.parts. So those are all the bits that make up our package. And then we could go and get each one of those things loaded up. Now, to do assembly part.load, you need a stream. And the way of getting that stream is that we can walk up to the application and try and get it. So we can say stream if we had the namespace. Stream equals, and let's say application dot get resource stream. We feed that a URI, so the URI is assembly part dot source, and that is a relative URI, I think. So we've got the stream. Oh no, sorry, we will have the stream if we ask for it. So we've got the stream for that part of the package. And then we can ask the assembly part to load that, so we could say assembly. Equals assembly part dot load from that stream, and then we could construct an assembly catalog from that. So we could say our aggregate catalog adds a new assembly catalog around that assembly. And so what we're effectively saying is, figure out all the assemblies that we've been packaged with and build an aggregate catalog from them, and use that aggregate catalog to instantiate the container and feed that container into being our default container, specifically the one that is picked up by part initializer satisfy imports. And if we press F5 on that, assuming we didn't make any mistakes in building it, we should see that we've got a word processor composed for us onto our main page with the text engine. So what we've just done here is pretty much written out the code longhand that MEF will run for you anyway if you don't get involved in creating the container and the catalogs. So we've really just done it to introduce the idea that this is all going on in the background for you, and of course you can do more flexible things with it. But there'd be no point in writing this code here, because if you don't write any code with MEF and you simply call part initializer satisfy imports, it will pretty much do this stuff here anyway. It will look at the current package, find all the assemblies, find all the exported types, put them into a container for you, and initialize the default container with that container. So effectively, if we were to just remove everything we have here at the moment, let's delete that code and let's delete that code, then what we've got on the screen is pretty much equivalent to where we've just had that code working. Let's press F5 on this, and MEF is doing the same thing of looking at the package, and if you just get our breakpoint, where's it gone? This guy here. Then we still get a compose word processor consisting of a text engine, which must be done by looking in that package and finding all the assemblies and finding all the exports from them. So, you know, we've just kind of duplicated behavior that's already there by default. But we did it in order to illustrate that there are these catalogs in flight and that you can obviously do more things with them than just what we're doing here right now. So another thing to add about catalogs is that we've looked at three here. We've looked at the type catalog, the assembly catalog, the aggregate catalog. If we look at any one of them, we'll find that they are all derived from a composable part catalog. And this represents the essence of what MEF knows about catalogs and what it means to be a catalog. If we jump to the definition of this, then we can see the bare essence of being a catalog here is to have a queryable collection of parts and to be able to answer that question around, given an import, give me some exports. What this means, this abstract class here, is that you can, of course, build your own catalogs. So it's perfectly possible to go and build your own implementations of composable part catalog and do anything you want. And there's more extensibility that we'll perhaps talk about in a subsequent video that goes beyond even catalogs. However, what we'll do is we'll look in the next video at another kind of catalog that isn't in the core framework right now as part of the beta, but is in the preview Silverlight toolkit that goes alongside Silverlight 4. So we'll come back in the next video and look at another kind of catalog, which is a really interesting one for downloading parts of an application pretty much at runtime in a very flexible way. So we'll draw a line on this. You've seen the three different kind of catalogs here. We've looked at type catalog, we looked at assembly catalog, we looked at aggregate catalog. We looked at how those are put into a container, and we looked at how to make that container the default or the implicit container that is used by code such as, where's our guy, part initializer satisfy imports. We looked how to set up this implicit container that is used by that kind of code. So we looked at quite a few things there. And we'll come back in the next video and look at another kind of catalog.